As I was introduced to him about, I imagine, 7 years ago here at Holden. And in the interim, I have read perhaps the majority of his books. First of all, I probably should tell you who he is. Paul Tournier is a Swiss physician and psychiatrist. And we can read some of the flaps here on the covers. They say he is a prominent Swiss psychologist. He began practice of medicine in Geneva in 1928, so that puts him as a rather old man now. I would guess about 70. And he has probably done more than any other person alive today to sort of bring in Christianity and psychiatry. He has written widely. I have some of his books here which are available for you to read before I leave. I didn't bring all of the books that I have of him. There are also three here in the library. My introduction to him was through The Meaning of Persons. Unfortunately, I didn't bring that along because both of my two or three copies are out on loan. I use it a great deal with students at the University of California. It's sort of a good way to introduce them to something better. If you ask a person today, a student, or even I have many people who apply for positions, one of my questions to them is, what do you want out of life? What are you here for? I mean, what's it all about? This usually disarms them because they will not admit to having even faced the question. Now, I'll tell you first about my meeting with Paul Tournier. Those of you who know me know that I'm not fluent in any language. If I have a language, it's probably Norwegian, which is the first one I learned. I have a materialistic German learned in prison camp. I have resisted strenuously learning French. This is unfortunate because that is the language of Paul Tournier. And when I wrote to my good friend Oscar Rolander, when I knew I was going to Europe a few weeks ago, I wanted to see Oscar and I wanted him to show me Geneva. And so, and I told him that I certainly would look forward to meeting with Paul Tournier. And he says, well, you better not see him unless your French is really good. So I kind of wrote it off, but reluctantly. Well, I went over there to conduct the business I had to do at several cities. And I came back to Geneva to visit again. Oscar was gone, so I visited with his wife, Doris, and Luella Peterson, who some of you may know from Gustavus Adolphus, whose folks are missionaries in Tanzania. She's a graduate nurse from Gustavus Adolphus. And we went to the services, the Sunday services, at the English-speaking church, at a German church. It also doubles as a German church in Geneva. And heard a great sermon that day. And afterwards, we were outside of the church talking. And Luella Peterson saw this girl who was the organist. Her name is Gloria Floyne. And she says, you know, that girl looks familiar. I wonder where I've seen her. And so we went up and talked to her. And turned out that they were both at Gustavus Adolphus at the same time. Gloria Floyne is very fluent in French. And she is a student at the Catholic universities in the humanities right now and also working on music. And so I said, let's go out to dinner. So we went to a tavern right near there. It's a tavern. It's the only one there that doesn't serve a hard liquor, it turns out. And you can get a meal for six people for a pittance, it turns out. I think the Salvation Army runs it. And it was good food. And we sat outside. And Gloria was sitting at my right. I usually manage to, as much as possible, to sit near pretty girls. And we were visiting, and I said, you know, I one of the great disappointments is that I wasn't able to see Paul Tournier while I'm here. And she says, well, let's call him up. I saw him about 6 weeks ago. And so she went to call him. I give her some whatever you give to get in the phone there. I'm all mixed up on money right now. But she couldn't reach him. But later on in the afternoon, she did reach him. And I wanted to see him at a time when my son would also join me. He was then in London, since he's entering medicine, or will finish up in medicine soon. And we made arrangements then to meet him a week ago last Tuesday at 9:30. And characteristic, perhaps, of Paul Turnier, he suggested that since he had business in town anyway, we'd meet at the Landort, which is a kind of a little coffee house out at the University of Geneva. And to make sure we were there, oh, we weren't sure it was 9 or 9:30, so we came at 8:50, and I got a nice big table out under the tree, sort of on the outside the restaurant. And pretty much on time, 9:30, Paul Turnier showed up. And we happened to have taken a walk because we saw a car pull up down below and thought it was him. It wasn't, but I felt I knew him from even about 100 feet. So we exchanged pleasantries and then sat down. And of course, preparatory to this is, as I suggest for all of you, if you're going to have this kind of a discussion, you give it a lot of thought before you enter it, and you probably never do give it enough thought, because you've got to make each sort of moment count. And I do this probably with anybody whose time is exceedingly valuable. And I write down certain questions that I wish to pursue. And this is what I did with him. Initially, he said, my English is very bad, so we must speak French. And of course, that's why Gloria was along. Of course, Gloria was looking forward to this very much, as was Mrs. Roland, Doris Rolander, and Luella. I never know about my son. He doesn't, he breasts his card. The first thing I told him was that I was very pleased, as were my many friends, that he had recovered, because he was very ill this past year. And I think he was rather surprised that somebody in California knew that he'd been ill. And then I said that his books had meant a very great deal to me and to my many associates, and I'd used them a great deal there at the University of California and at Holden Village, because you always got to get this pitch in, you see. And mentioned various ones of them and how I had used them. And then Gloria started to translate, what I just said. And he stopped her and he says, compliments I understand in English. But from then on, I think he followed some of it. I tried to speak, slowly and distinctly, but from there on, then it went pretty much through the translator. The thing that I, there was two pressing problems that had come up, and one of them that really bugged me, and that has to do with to understand one another. And this is a most useful book for any couple. And I often give it to couples who are about to be married, and some afterwards. It's a remarkable book. It says on the cover, when we talk of marriage counseling, we think immediately of the extreme cases of threats to seek divorce, of couples in violent dispute who frequently come to blows, he says. But there are many other couples whose marriages are no less a failure. They live side by side without hurting one another, but poles apart, because of no real understanding of one another. Courtship's complete frankness has given way to superficial exchanges of information. The husband and wife fail to realize that they are hiding part of their real feelings from each other. I see many couples. Behind their difficulties, I always discover a lack of mutual openness, a loyal and total openness to one another, without which there can be no real understanding. And so he addresses this subject in this very wonderful book. And I told him, however, that I had just sent off for another shipment on paperbacks. And they came not under the title of to understand each other, but it came under the title of marriage difficulties. You know? I mean, here I got a box of these, you know? And am I about to that couple there, you know, in your church you can send sort of this and say, boy, you'd be ready to turn you, you know? Here's one for you, marriage difficulties, you know? Well, and at least I can't bring myself to do that, or even for a young couple about to be married, you know, here's one for you, marriage difficulties. And I explained this to him, and he of course realized this problem, because this is sort of the exact translation, I guess, from the French, where in this to understand each other, which is the same book, and I don't know why somebody in their right mind could do this to me. but they did. But he's trying to do something about it. Yeah, I guess so. But the other problem we had with this book has to do, and it's also, I think, reiterated in Secrets, which is, I think, every young mother with a child should have this, and everyone with a spouse. And those, I guess, that even that don't. But they're both very useful books. And in here somewhere, oh yes, boy, there's a big question mark. And this looks like Chief's question mark, too. So we both question this, as we did in our church discussion groups. And some of these books are very good for church discussion groups. When instituting marriage, God declared, they shall no longer be two but one. To be one obviously means not to have secrets from each other. And I had felt, and so did the chief. That's my wife. And she's here and she can hear this, you see, so she, you know, she can speak for herself if she wants to. But we really questioned this, as did the group at church, and one of them was a psychologist when this book was discussed. Is this really true? You know, and this is one of the first questions I asked Turner, you know. Do you really mean this, or have you changed your mind since you wrote it? No, he says, I still hold to that. He says, but this is the ultimate. This is what it really should be, but probably never is, but it should be a sort of a fresh renewal every morning, and that this is what you should advance to. This is the goal that you have set. That's what he said. Now, another problem, of course, that perplexes me, as it must perplex all of you, and that has to do, well, before I get on that, I asked him another thing. I said, you know, of all the books you've written, and the ones I have here, the meaning of persons, guilt and grace, which to Mary Schrem and myself was probably most important, probably to Mary because she appreciates grace, for me because I have so much guilt, but you know, we have our own reasons. It's a remarkable book. Secrets, to resist or to surrender, seasons of life, escape from loneliness, the whole person in a broken world, a doctor's case book in light of the Bible, the adventures of living, fatigue in the modern society, the person reborn, and I just started the person reborn. I don't have a long. I started reading in Geneva, and he the way he opens his book, it kind of gives you an insight into this. He said, as a child, he had visions of grandeur. I mean, you always want to, you know, be great. And he got out, I suppose, sort of an erector set. And he was going to build a machine, you know, that was really remarkable, that was going to probably create life or something. And so he was putting it on, and the gears and everything on this machine. And unfortunately, his sister happened to come along, and she asked him what it was. And he told her what it was, that this was going to be a great machine that would create life. Well, unfortunately for him, she asked him, how does it work? And he was stuck. Well, he says, I'm going to pray and pray and pray to God, and he will make it possible. And then she asked me, well, what are all the gears for? That's how he starts out the book. And I mean, you really like him. And A Place for You is another book. Well, I said, you know, of all these books, you know, which one gave you the greatest satisfaction to have written it? Or, you know, you felt the best about? And he kind of smiled, and he has very expressive eyes. And he said, the next one. Which I thought was a pretty good answer. And I said, what is the next one? And he's working on one in an area that I'm very interested in. And you probably look at me and figure that out. But it's on aging and the problem of the aged. And I'm really looking forward to it. He does get to it a bit in The Seasons of Life. But the problem, and a great problem, I said, what do you tell? What do you tell your good friends when their firstborn, who is 27 months or something, falls into the neighbor's swimming pool and dies? Or very fresh in my mind at that moment, because just the day before, Dr. Gross, Lutheran World Federation, on hearing through Carl Mao, a mutual friend, that I, who is involved in cancer research, was in town, calls me up and tells how his middle child, 10 and a half, Kari by name, developed some nodules on her neck a few weeks before. And then on the various tests, eventually they look into the bone marrow and say, this is lymphatic lymphoma. And that, if you don't know it, is bad news. Very bad news. And as he went on and asking the usual questions, sometimes cry. Or what do you tell the people who have lost their exceptional child, the handicapped child, or the parents who have lost their only child because he has taken his own life and he's about to enter medicine with one of the highest grades of the entering class. What do you tell these people? And he looked at me for quite a while. And he said, I do a lot of listening. But I says, you have to tell him something. He says, I do not know. And then my son, we went on with this for quite a while, or for a little while. And my son said, because he's facing this now, do you ever lie to your patients? And he waited hardly at all to answer that. He says, every day, every day. And this brings up a very important subject. In this context, say, of cancer. And we then asked him, you know, I mean, what about telling a person that he has cancer? Because the night before, my son and I and a number of other people in the field of medicine or biology and medicine and research had been out to dinner in Epion and had discussed, among other things, this problem of cancer and do you tell? Well, some maintain you do not tell. And sort of what is truth at this stage of the game, you see? I mean, I don't want you to think of Paul Tournier as a liar. I mean, we're all liars, but... But in this case, this is a very touchy issue, because I'm reminded of what one lady said. She was not yet at middle age. She had an incurable disease. Her physician was a very good friend. And one day, things hadn't gone real well for him, and probably she was a bit short too. And in exchange, in conversation, he said to her, "Well, after all, we do have our limitations." In other words, he sort of, crossed her off. And the next day, she told him that, you and I are very good friends, but I ask that you never tell any of your patients what you told me yesterday, because what we expect from you is hope. Hot soup is best blown on before you take it in. And in this regard, to many people, if you tell them they have cancer, it's like despair. That's the end. Yet I can name many cancers for you that, especially if it's diagnosed early, cervical cancer, probably over 99%. Right now, Hodgkin's, for example, if you get it early and treat it right, a lot of my friends, 18, 20 years down the road, I know of a lot of patients where they say, "Boy, you got cancer," and it just flattens them. And it's like they're getting their death certificate, yet they go on, and sometimes, it isn't like that at all. So that's some basis for this. And Paul Tournier said, that there are very few people who can really take this, just like that. I have arrangements with my physician that, if any of this shows up in me, if I have an incurable disease, cancer or anything, I have an understanding with them. You're to tell me. I don't want you to fiddle-faddle around. But a lot of people can't take this. Now, maybe in health, you can say this. But if you're really knocked down and feeling lousy, maybe you can't. That's another hooker in this business. And I said, it's very difficult. We love much, and we are fiercely tied to the touch of a hand, a gleam in the eye, and a sound of a voice. And I told him this, and he said, and he sort of departed from this at that moment. He said, we really are, and in my business, I hardly ever take any appointments over the phone. I was lucky, this girl lined it up for me. But but he says, I like to see them, and discuss it with them, because I like to see their eyes and their response. And I told him one of the techniques I use, and it's a very cruel one, everybody tells me. When I'm interviewing people for positions, especially of considerable responsibility, or postdoctorals or something like that, I'll get them in, exchange maybe a few pleasantries, and they'll ask me, what do you want out of life? And I may just sit there and look at them for a while, and look away, and see if they can take the silence. Because this is used quite a bit in psychiatry. And he says, it's a very good idea, you learn quite a bit this way. Because some people can't stand it, and then they really start talking. Sometimes about things they really weren't planning to discuss. I another problem, of course, one I often discuss up here, is the problem of alcoholism, and I'd wondered about, whether that in his writings he had not really taken this problem up, although he did mention it in a few of his books, and recognize the tremendous problem that it is. It's certainly one of the great curses on earth. It was Toynbee that said, there's the three greatest hazards to our civilization today is war, nuclear war, racism, and alcoholism. It's sort of the big three, you know. And he had not really addressed this subject and didn't plan on, because some of his associates dealt with it, but he felt that, you know, there's, although he's tried to write on quite a few subjects, this is one that he was going to leave to somebody else. And then we got off on the subject of youth. First of all, he did interrupt at this stage, and he says, you know, there's one thing. I mean, he says, I'm very fond of Americans because they have this great desire to do better and to try to do new things. He says, this is not so true in Europe, like in Switzerland and many other countries. They say, well, why try that? We tried it in 1200 and it didn't work, you know? So you'll go along. And he says, sure, you make more mistakes probably, but he felt good that, about this and still had some optimism. And what I had in this youth bit, oh, first of all, I forgot to tell you something on this matter of discussing imminent death or possible imminence of death. He says, it reminds me of his very close friend who was a surgeon. And this surgeon had a son who developed leukemia at a fairly young age. And to make the matter doubly worse, this son told his father that he knew everything would be all right, since his father was a physician and would cure him. Now, I'm here to tell you there aren't very many cures with leukemia, especially the acute leukemia of the young, or even the chronic form that may go suddenly to acute leukemia. It's one of the really heartrending thing. And so this went on, and they played the game, you see. The father would visit the son, and they sort of kept these things from one another, and the son died. And not long after his death, a good friend of his son met the father, and they had a discussion. And the father then learned from his son's friend that his son really knew. He didn't expect his father to cure him. He knew that he had an incurable disease. He knew that he was going to die. But they had not shared this. He thought this was unfortunate. I do too. Now, when I was going down the streets of Geneva, there was a sign over the place where you could buy papers, and it was something about Tournier and youth. I don't read French, very few words. So I said, Gloria, let's buy this and we'll see what he's saying about youth. And one of the things he said about youth was that he was encouraged by the enthusiasm of youth, and he felt that his part of it was to blow on the embers. And I said that I was interested in his article on youth, and I wondered about this and how he meant this. I wondered if there wasn't some importance in the direction of your blowing, how hard you blew and which way you blew, if you get what I mean. I think he did. And he says, well, yes, this is a very difficult question. He just says it is unfortunate that so much of their enthusiasm is so misdirected, but that there is still hope there. And he says, in this society today, and the problems that he sees is principally one that in this age of advanced technology, that there is complete depersonalization. And he says, this is, from his standpoint, the basic source of the problem. And he says, I see only one solution to this problem, and it is the church. And I says, but the church has its problems, you know? I mean, how can it do it? Shouldn't it do something about itself first? And he says, no, they must do it from where they are. And he says, unfortunately, the church in Europe is just playing a game, and they're afraid of dialogue, which is really the solution to the problem, that we must enter into dialogue to form the micro-communities, to get at the root issues and to learn to know each other as people. I think the kind of communities, for example, that Pastor Schrem will be telling you about, such as the Community of Christ. We're trying to get out of the way in our church. I'm trying to initiate something at the University of California. I might relate to this later, but I've had letters from students as a result of a Holden experience here. For example, last fall, one girl wrote and said, you're the first professor I knew as a person. Now, this was not a student from a state university. I won't tell you, but it was one of the church colleges, and she was a graduate. I wouldn't be surprised from the University of California. I have students come up to me and say, will you write me a letter of recommendation? Recently, a very lovely young girl came and asked me for this. What was my introduction to them? I had given, to this class, and they're entering professional school, I take them for a tour of the laboratory, and I give them a discussion on the art of listening, which I will be discussing with you in the morning, I think. And she had heard me probably in one or two lectures, a class of 85. And I am the person she thought knew her best. Now there's something wrong with that. And that's part of the source of her problem. But he says probably many of the pastors here and in many places are operating outside the church. Many people have occupations, a religious endeavor outside the church. That doesn't say we shouldn't try to do it also within the church, as we are certainly doing, and Davis and many of you are doing. But he says the church must supply the leadership to establish a dialogue. I think that's pretty much the highlights of a very memorable visit with a truly remarkable man. And I really felt, as I'm writing him now, and he also told me, I had to see the visit a fellow in California who's a very good friend of his, because he's been working with a group on the medicine of the person. It's called the Bossy Group, and one of his friends and associates in this is a fellow at Hemet, California. And I'm going to write to him, and one of the things I'm going to tell him, you know, I really felt like, as I sat there talking to Paul Tierney, that I had really known him for many years through his books. You know? And it was a most interesting discussion, certainly the highlights of a very memorable trip. And I really wish you could have been there, because this is a pretty poor substitute for talking to Tierney. But you can, in a way, listen to him by reading his books. And I told some of you, you know, to bring books, bring along and read maybe some of your passages. Did any of you bring any? Or don't you have them along? I saw somebody had... Have you got some? Do you have any there you want to talk about? Or you want to look through it? I'll read. I can read a couple out of some of mine here.
Oh, man.
Yes. Yeah, you...
In the talk you've already given us. You mentioned that Tierney said that he lies to his patients quite frequently.
He doesn't tell them the full truth.
I'm not yours, but I was told by the people. Does this apply only to patients who have an incurable disease or faced with death, or does
no.
I understand it to apply to other situations?
Definitely.
does he consider the But this, well, it's not under the face of it. I suppose he considers his relationship with his patients to be a very grave and responsible relationship. And he considers the husband and wife relationship to be a very grave and responsible relationship. And if so, then doesn't this contradict the openness, the complete openness that he recommends between husband and wife?
I'll answer that at least partially. Not so much in the husband and wife thing, but I can't think of something right real fast there. I think I could or anything. Many husbands and wife, I think, at least in initial relationship or even later, were they perfectly candid? Probably if they were perfectly candid and before marriage, the marriage would never be consummated. Or if they spoke to each other before marriage like they do after, it would never be consummated either. But I know in my relationship with my associates, you know, or we have a problem or something, and if I was perfectly candid and absolutely honest, you know, with this person on the initial meeting, it would essentially draw the curtain, and that's all she wrote. So it has to be a developmental thing, a progressive thing, as one becomes, say, more honest with this person. It's like the hot soup, you know. You got to blow on it first, and pretty soon you can maybe take it hotter. This is sort of how I look at it. If you show me somebody that says they never lied, and I'll show you the biggest liar in the world.
Well, coming right back to his recommendation and the complete honesty between husband and wife, then an element of contradiction.
Yeah, well, no, that's a progressive thing, though. This is your goal.
But he didn't state that in his recommendation in the husband and wife relationship.
Well, he told it to me.
Yeah, please put it in his book.
But it doesn't seem to me that comparison is the same. I mean, you know, the place says that a doctor-patient relationship should be the same as a husband-wife relationship.
Well, we established them both as being a great relationship established on a trust, mutual respect, mutual trust.
It seems to me that it does shake my confidence in anything a doctor is going to tell me now. From here on in, I'm not going to be totally reassured when he tries to reassure me.
Well, just so it doesn't ever shake the confidence.
Don't you remember what Dr. Osler, remember what you're going to say, you know, in respect to this, you know. Chief, you remember this, huh? And we could say the same thing today as Dr. Osler told the 1912 graduating class of Yale, I think it was. I have two very disturbing pieces of information to get. The first is that half of what you have been taught isn't true. And the other thing is that we don't know which half it is. So that element is also in there, Chief, you know? I mean, what we think is truth today, tomorrow, especially in science, you know, isn't true tomorrow. I mean, boy, look down the list of drugs, for example. Boy, we laugh about it now. Right? Yes.
I was going to say, too, that it has always kind of bothered me that what I consider to be my own privileged information, which would be the state of my health, in a way becomes the privileged information of the community, so that everyone knows but me and I would suspect. And this bothers me very much. I think we've got something screwed up there. And I'm also bothered by the doctor who is so godlike that he decides. I don't buy that kind of doctor. I wouldn't go to him.
I think we're breeding a new, you know, we got a new breed of cats coming up. You know, I mean, I've had a lot of talks with my son about this, and we've spent a lot of time talking on this trip, and I am concerned about this, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff, shirts, and business. I mean, we find out that physicians are human, too, and sometimes they're more human than others. And so they, you know, to think that man acts logically is illogical. But we have to leave sort of the door open. And see, I'm getting ready to write Dr. Gross a letter, you know, about his daughter. These letters are hard to write. I've never met this man except by the phone. But you see, one of the things in seeking information on this, one of my close friends is this lady. She's a hematologist in our medical school. And how you do this, you know, whether you tell them on cancer or not, and I think it's a kind of a neat way to do it. Your problem is that you have too many white cells, and it doesn't leave room for the red cells. And what we have to do is to reduce the number of the white cells. Now at that point, you know, you can leave it at that. You then leave it to the patient. He can either pursue it or he can let it go at that and go from there. But you're right, this doctor-patient relationship, I mean, it's news, especially bad news, travels fast, because people like to hear bad news, except about themselves.
From the doctor's standpoint, too, I can remember when I'm a nurse and I was in the hospital, a doctor was telling me about a patient who begged to be told. And the doctor said, I made a point of never telling the truth to my patients because I just didn't feel it, that I really could, not knowing how they'd react. And he said, this patient, he felt he knew very well and had a very good relationship with the patient. And when the patient begged and begged and begged to be told, the doctor finally said, tell him, and he gave it to him straight. And that night, the patient jumped out of the fourth floor window and said, he committed suicide. And the doctor said, I will never again.
Now, there's several cases like this.
Why did you get this choice?
I agree. The person at least has self-determination.
Would this be an artist spark the discussion? Would this, just an artist spark the discussion, would this also have an application to the husband and wife relationship? Fortunately, our home is only one story. So my wife wouldn't have any four story rooms to jump out of.
Well, maybe you'll have to get an apartment.
I think you're just wondering if it would apply ever to have an application for the right relationship.
I think it does.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I don't know the context of that one phrase, should have no secrets, because just those words, out of context, I think most people would disagree with, I would. The most uninteresting person in the world, and I wouldn't want that girl to be my wife, the woman to be my wife, would be the one who has no secrets. And Bonhoeffer, in Life Together, talking about Christian community, said, but you must keep some secrets. You know, community does not mean you're totally known by anybody out there, any group of people. But we may be, I don't know, maybe everybody else has read that phrase. You ask him specifically whether he thought differently after he wrote that.
This is what you see.
Audrey Newton himself said in his little book on secrets that everybody has to have secrets from each other, even children.
Yeah. No, especially children.
Yeah. No.
That's how they grow up. Yeah, well, this is still bothering me. And
maybe it was in the translation from the French. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I got to write to Gloria too, and I boy, I
how old the man is turning?
I think he's well. You see, I think around 70, because he started practicing medicine and psychiatry at 20 in 28. You see, so he was probably near 28 at that time.
Is his wife living?
Yes. Yes, in fact, she was rather put out when this girl called her on Sunday afternoon for an appointment.
Does he have children?
Yes. I think one of his children is a physician.
Okay.
Ah, that's right, Gifts. I was going to read you a few. Yeah, you know how I felt, Pastor Trim, is that, you know, yeah, I guess you couldn't have any secrets with your wife or anyone else. You know, on some of it, if you didn't believe in the forgiveness of sins. Yeah, you would, you know, if you didn't believe in the forgiveness of sins, then you better not have any secrets from your wife. Or maybe a better, huh?
As I understand, isn't he trying to tell us that your mental can often heal your physical? I mean, our physical and mental live so close together, they catch each other's diseases. So that maybe why he lies to his patients about the physical is because he doesn't want to add to that the mental despair. And that maybe by having an upward look, there's more hope for that.
You've got to be selective in your lying, and you've got to have a good memory. But this is probably part of the therapy. But in this mental and physical, you know, this is, you know, you can't draw the line there, as you're pointing out, you know. One of my good friends is Sam Martin. Sam Martin was in charge of biological sciences in the medical school at Florida. He's now up at Harvard. And he's an immunologist type. I mean, his position, an administrator now, and much sought after from the standpoint of, you know, consultation in medical economics and all, and he says, my children, when they're growing up, you know, may they come down with a cold, usually I'll sit down and let's talk, you know. He says, what's bugging you, you know? Usually there's something bugging them, you know, other than just bugs. So, I mean, just to point out, you know, there's a relationship.
You know,
yeah, it's not the full truth, you see. I mean, let's just ask around. Is there anybody here that has always told the full truth?
Well, in some of these, I'm sure in his mind are because that he can't, you know, put a definite answer on. I mean, what his suspicions are. Is it right for a doctor to tell you a suspicion when he's not sure?
Because you don't know what the whole truth is sometimes either. And what you know as truth may not be truth. You have cancer and you're soon going to die. Well, that isn't always 100%. If you have cervical cancer and we got it early, so you're gonna live a long time. Well, maybe that isn't 100% either.
We had a lady in our church in Minneapolis who had cancer. The doctor told her she had perhaps 6 months to live, and she lived 6 years.
No.
And gave a wonderful witness in the meantime. With her, it was all right. No. I'm just saying it would be all right for anybody to know.
Yeah. Attorney made this point in that regard. He says, you really have to know them well, you know. You really have to have them, you know.
Well, maybe the husband or the wife should be the one to determine whether they should know
them. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of wondering if they're probably the last one to tell them. I don't know. It depends on the relationship.
They shouldn't tell them, but I mean, should they determine whether or not they should be told? But who knows the better?
Yeah. But they're so emotionally involved, you know. It's
I think a husband or a wife would be more able to determine than a doctor whether or not you could take it.
part of the problem too. Doctor David Gilbert has as much problem as some of the patients.
You see, death is an active process. And you nurses will realize this, as my son sees it and as the statistics show. If a child, especially a child, says that, you know, all right, I'm going into surgery now, and I'm not going to live, the chances are very high. I mean, it's a poor surgical risk. A very poor surgical risk. This is true with anybody, but most prominent in children, but anybody else, you know, too. A lot of times, and the studies show this, that if they don't think they're going to make it, they well may be right. And I know in the case of my mother, on Friday night, she had really rallied, I mean, and they'd sent me back to Holden Village just a year ago now. I mean, you know, if I'd have known this, I wouldn't have called you home. A few days or 3 weeks before, I wouldn't have challenged her to a day's work. And on Friday evening, she was really doing well. The physician, the family physician, knows her well. Said, so now, Thora, you got to be it's 4 days to your 80th birthday, you know. You got to be up and around because, I'll be singing happy birthday for you. He's a pretty good singer. And she said, I don't think I'm going to make it to 80. You know, he says, none of my family ever made it 80 years old. And they went on from here, and that night, I mean, you put a lot of stock in them. I mean, she's hearing without her hearing aid, and a re-clear and a bell. And she was right. She was checked at midnight, sleeping soundly. At 4 o'clock, she was dead. So it is, and there are many studies now on this. Elizabeth somebody Ross at the University of Chicago, I think Dudley at the University of Washington,